Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We read from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th canto, chapter 2, entitled Daksha Curses Lord Shiva. Text number 2. Kastam chara chara gurum. Nirvairam shanta vigraham. Admaramam katam dvesti. Jagato daivatam maha. Kastam chara chara gurum. Nirvairam shanta vigraham. Admaramam katam dvesti. Jagato daivatam maha. Kastam chara chara gurum. Nirvairam shanta vigraham. Admaramam katam dvesti. Jagato daivatam maha. Ka. Who? Daksha. Tam. Him. Lord Shiva. Chara chara. Of the whole world. Both animate and inanimate. Gurum. The spiritual master. Nirvairam. Without enmity. Shantavigraham. Having a peaceful personality. Admaramam. Satisfied in himself. Katam. How? Dvesti. Hates. Jagata. Of the universe. Daivatam. Demigod. Mahat. The great. Translation. Lord Shiva, the spiritual master of the entire world, is free from enmity, is a peaceful personality, and is always satisfied in himself. He is the greatest amongst the demigods. How is it possible that Daksha could be inimical towards such an auspicious personality? Lord Shiva is described here as Chara Chara Guru, the spiritual master of all animate and inanimate objects. He is sometimes known as Bhutanath, which means the worshipful deity of the dull-headed. Buddha is also sometimes taken to indicate the ghosts. Lord Shiva takes charge of reforming persons who are ghosts and demons, not to speak of others who are godly. Therefore, he is the spiritual master of everyone, both the dull and the demoniac, and the highly learned Vaishnavas. It is also stated, Vaishnavanam yata Shambhu. Shambhu, Lord Shiva, is the greatest of all Vaishnavas. On one hand, he is the worshipable object of the dull demons, and on the other, he is the best of all Vaishnavas or devotees, and he has a sampradaya called the Rudra Sampradaya. Even if he is an enemy or sometimes angry, such a personality cannot be the object of envy. So Vidura, in astonishment, asked why he was taken as such, especially by Daksha. Daksha is also not an ordinary person. He is a Prajapati, in charge of fathering population, and all of his daughters are highly elevated, especially Sati. The word Sati means the most chaste. Whenever there is consideration of chastity, Sati, this wife of Lord Shiva and daughter of Daksha, is considered first. Vidura therefore was astonished. Daksha is such a great man, he thought, and he's the father of Sati, and Lord Shiva is the spiritual master of everyone. How then could there be possibly so much enmity between them that Sati, the most chaste goddess, could give up her body because of their quarrel? Om Agyana Timanandasya Gananana Salakaya Chakshur Minitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktavinna Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So Prahlad Maharaj is praying. In the fifth canto, we find a verse, Swasti Astu Visvasya Kala Prasidati, which is referring to the following point, that everyone in the universe is heated and agitated, and that the process of devotional service can create an auspicious influence which can cool the hearts of all the living beings. So it is a fact that the material world is naturally a world of agitation, because the three modes of material nature, they create unlimited varieties of disturbing factors. And somehow or other, everyone will experience that sooner or later, that the situations are frustrating, that the three modes of material nature are just now taking shapes which are horrible. And all of us are going through this all the time. Other times, everything looks beautiful and for a moment very nice and peaceful, and everything seems to be fine, and then suddenly, there it comes again. Oh yeah, here we go again. And we know, well, the modes are going to do it again. And it seems that a problem never comes alone, somehow or other. Of course, that's just maybe the experience of the observer who goes through all these difficulties. But it seems that they stack up and come many at once. Whatever may be, the three modes of material nature are certainly not problem-free. And the result is agitation. And therefore, it is difficult to fulfill one's plans. The Lord is described to be Parameshwar, or the Supreme Controller, and all living entities are also known to be Isvaras, or Controllers. So it is completely natural that everyone has a plan and a desire how he wants to do things. Every single living entity has his own idea how he wants to do it. We can see, maybe not so much here, but in Vrindavan, when you sit in Bhagavatam class, then there are always many insects crawling over the floor, and there's always these ants coming, and they want to crawl on you. And then everyone is kind of moving the ants on, you know, trying to move them to the side, and you give them a little push, and you see them turn around, only to come back again. They're very stubborn. They just keep on going to the same thing. Finally, you manage to push them onto your neighbor, and then you see that he does the same thing. This is a pastime in Bhagavatam class there. Once we had a plague of grasshoppers in Vrindavan, big green grasshoppers. The whole town was covered, and the whole temple room. And in that case, Bhagavatam class became impossible because the grasshoppers were just jumping around on the speaker, off the speaker, and to the public. It was quite something. But anyway, it shows that even little insects do not like to be deviated from their plan. They have a particular plan. I want to go this direction, and no matter what you do, you brush them away, comes back in the same direction. So we human beings are certainly like that. And we don't like it if someone crosses our direction and says, you can't go here. Immediately, why not? You know, this is there in everyone. Or if we have a plan and other people are part of it, we always feel, why can't they cooperate? Why can't they just cooperate? You know, why do they have to make trouble? So Daksha also felt like that. Daksha was the mental son of Lord Brahma, and as a Prajapati meant for the population, or populating the entire universe. So he begot many sons, And it was very difficult for him if anyone was just not cooperating. I mean, after all, he was a great leader, meant to guide many people. He was respectable. He was a direct son of Lord Brahma. And he was used to it, that his sons would cooperate with him. So that was his spirit. Therefore, he was very much accustomed to this, that his plans were being supported and listened to, because he was a respectable person. So therefore, he felt that respect was naturally due to him. And when his daughter became married to Lord Shiva, then he felt that it wasn't required for him to offer respects to Lord Shiva, because he looked at the situation from the external point of view. He's married my daughter, so he's become like my son. So therefore, he needs to respect me, and I do not need to offer any respect to him. It came completely natural, this kind of thinking. But on the other hand, he overlooked the position of Lord Shiva in general, that Lord Shiva is also not just an ordinary mental son of Lord Brahma, that he also did appear from Lord Brahma, but that Lord Shiva is a highly powerful personality, a very transcendental personality, one of the great controllers within the universe, and certainly even greater than Lord Brahma, what to speak of Daksha. So taking it from that perspective, he was certainly due to offer respect to Lord Shiva, according to his actual position. But he just looked at the social position, and in this way there was confusion, and Daksha offended Lord Shiva by not respecting him properly. And so many things came from this, and then from one thing came the next. It is very interesting to see how in the exchanges then between the two, initially there is some irritation coming. So when irritation comes, that is the beginning of a lot of trouble. Because at that point, the irritation in one person can easily bring about irritation in another person as well, and before you know it, tit for tat, and at that point one doesn't care anymore. And the next thing is, offenses can be made, and that is what happened. Daksha lost it, committed offenses, started to call Lord Shiva all kinds of names, just because Lord Shiva was irritated that he wasn't respected. And then Daksha after that just really gave it to him. And subsequently the reactions were inconceivably great. So between Vaishnavas, that is a consideration. We oftentimes are not conscious enough of this. Maybe it is due to our culture, or I could say lack of culture, because our culture is not a culture that is inviting respectful behavior. It's just not the way things are these days. Everything is casual. In the previous generations, there was a lot of respect, and there were many polite forms. Children would speak in polite forms to their parents. But these days, you know, everything has become just easygoing, relaxed, and English is becoming the common language, and in English there is only one way to address a person. It doesn't matter whether you're speaking about the Supreme Personality of Godhead, about a king, or about a dog, or anyone. It's just, hey, you, right? That's all. So it's an impoverishment of culture. The Vedic culture was a different culture. In the Vedic culture, there were all kinds of codes and etiquettes of dealing with one another, and there were all kinds of exchanges of respect. So such dealings had been found cumbersome in normal time by us. In modern time, we felt this is, you know, too difficult and too distant. We felt that all this formality in the relationships makes the relationships distant and cold and impersonal, and it's actually so much nicer if we can just address each other like intimate friends, just you instead of formal, you know, because then you feel very close. So that was the reasoning for throwing away all the old respectful forms. But the result has also been that now not only the dealings have become less respectful, it seems also that there is less respect in the heart of people. So that is the result. So the Vedic culture was helpful in that regards, that there was the natural exchange of respect according to a person's position, because that had an extra protective feature, right? And it was there to help to avoid committing offenses. Now, especially amongst devotees, we are seeing that offenses are absolutely disastrous. That is the most serious thing, and we see that the results of offenses is absolutely terrible. It said that the entire Yadu dynasty was just destroyed, the whole dynasty, over the offense of one of its members, just because Samba was approaching the sages and joking with them, and then the whole dynasty was cursed. Many cases we see the reactions are severe when a Vaishnava is offended. Especially when a senior Vaishnava is offended, it says the reactions for that are so great that anyone who is even connected to the whole matter is getting serious reactions. Everyone. We see that there are many examples of that. There was it Ramachandra Khan who criticized Lord Nityananda? I'm just not sure if I got the name right. I think so. He criticized Lord Nityananda and blasphemed him when he was coming to stay in the village, and told him that there was no place to stay and that he should just stay in some cow shed. And when he sat in the courtyard of the house, then he told him to leave from there, and afterwards he told his servants to dig up the earth from that place and throw it outside. So this was some heavy action. And the results of this offensive action was that the whole village was destroyed. The entire village. Not just that house, the whole village. So the reactions to offenses can be very serious and have a very destructive effect. And therefore, there are many warnings in the Srimad Bhagavatam about these principles, about how to avoid offending Vaishnavas. So this should become a important consideration in all our dealings. Somehow or other, we should solve our problems without committing offenses where possible. Serious difficulties and differences may come even between devotees because it's natural. It is very natural that differences come. Therefore, it is said that the position of a manager is the most different position, most difficult position, because a manager, he has to sometimes disagree with devotees, and that may cause fights and strains and stress, etc. And in the cause of that, so many things may be said. And these days, we tend to think that there are reactions involved in the exchanges that are taking place. We used to think, well, you know, when it's in the service of Krishna, it doesn't matter so much. I mean, you know, what can be done? These things sometimes happen, and we'll forget afterwards. And maybe there is a site like that, but there definitely is another site where there are reactions. So one must be careful in all conditions. So especially, that is a difficult position. I do recall, since I was actively involved in management for 17 years, and I remember a few heated discussions and a little firework flying around the room. But on the other hand, the truth must also be spoken, and one must, in the interest of Krishna, one must stand up. But there is a certain way to do it. And although one may have to be strong about a certain position, one must somewhere along the line remain a certain level of respect. This is very important amongst Vaishnavas, that we develop this spirit of respect in our dealings. Well, that's... we're not so used to that. So, at least looking at myself, I can see that in the beginning I was quite careless about these things, and I was quite concerned about things. You know, if I felt a certain thing needed to be done, then I was just, I didn't care. You know, it had to be done. It was for Krishna, it was for Prabhupada, it was important, and like if there was someone in the way, get out of my way, boom, right? And I was basically operating in that way. But I noticed with the years, of course, that I got many reactions. And they made me sometimes think. I remember when I was the temple commander, that one day, in Vrindavan, I was the temple commander, and one day I walked upstairs in the ashram, and there was one boy, he was a guest, and he was a French boy, and I didn't even know him, I never met him. And he just immediately came out to me, out of the room, and said, you think you are a big chief? You think you are a big chief? You are nothing, okay? Completely nothing. So it's just so intense, you know? And he flew right out of the door of his room, and I never even met him. I didn't see his face, and I was like, wow, you know? Wow, what was this, right? And I was kind of walking down, you know, like to my office and thinking about it. I said, God, what did I do to deserve this? Right? So, well, I calmed down a little bit, and I thought, you know, like, well, I guess, you know, it's not for something I've done to him, but it's for something I've done to other people. Yeah? I must have somehow or other done it to others, and now I'm getting it back. I guess I should take it like this. And I went through a few more experiences like this, some intense one. There was one boy... I made him in charge of serving prasadam, and he was doing great. But there was one problem, that the prasadam was at 2 o'clock, and at 2:15 he locked the door to the prasadam room, you know, because everyone has to come in time. So I went to him and said, look, you know, it's especially the devotees that work hard, you know, that sometimes come a little later. So, you know, isn't this a little too much, you know, like, and then he got so angry. And he said, you are too much, and I want to throw you outside and put stool in your mouth. I was like, wow. Again, I was a little shocked by the intense nature of the encounter. I could see that maybe I was getting reactions, even if I wasn't dealing on the moment itself so strong. And because ultimately... one has to somehow or other realize that it is a very rare opportunity when a devotee gets the chance to join this movement. And that those who take leading positions in this movement somehow or other have to be very accommodating. Because after all, many people over the years have left and have felt mistreated. Right? They have left and they're bitter over something, and now they're gone. And yeah, maybe their progress to the spiritual world has been somewhat hampered. So it is a great responsibility. So being in charge of devotees is certainly more than just being in charge of getting things done. Of course, I understand BBT is like, for example, since I'm sitting in BBT, I'm thinking BBT is different than managing a temple, although there's a nice temple also, and an ashram. Like when I was a temple president, my role was definitely different than when I was managing the Mayapur Samadhi, which was like a construction company, when you're managing a construction company or a book production company, in a way, you work with devotees, but a company is meant to produce the goods, so it is different. So we have to see that in such a setting, the results are very much there. Whereas ISKCON is a different structure and a different arrangement. ISKCON is a society which is meant to preach Krishna consciousness and to give shelter to anyone who comes and is looking for spiritual life. So these two things, preaching Krishna consciousness and giving shelter for those who are interested in spiritual life, are not always congenial. Sometimes we see that there is a conflicting situation between the interest of the preaching and the interest of those who are seeking shelter. So it seems that although the preaching is very, very important and may never be forgotten simultaneously, the giving shelter element seems to have preference. And we see that Prabhupada in his dealings ultimately went out of his way to save an individual and to somehow or other accommodate an individual, even if the person was like not able to function as much as possible. And where it was absolutely not possible, then what to do? But Prabhupada was very, very tolerant and accommodating and bending with people, and we see all kinds of extraordinary replies sometimes. Like just last week I was reading a letter that one devotee wrote to Prabhupada, and in the letter the devotee said, "I have so much service that I cannot always finish my 16 rounds," right? The devotee wrote in the letter. And then the letter Prabhupada wrote back, it was shocking to me, because the letter was that, well, you work so hard, even if you don't finish your 16 rounds, that's all right. I never expected that reply, and I was shocked. Right? I think, wow, what is this, you know? But we see that Prabhupada wouldn't write to... He only wrote to that devotee like that. Of course, I know that devotee, and I know he's always chanting his rounds anyway. And if he got rounds behind, I knew he was making them up. So he was serious. So maybe that's why Prabhupada kind of wrote to him in this mood. I don't know, because I can't second guess Prabhupada. But whatever may be, I could see that he was very, very accommodating. I also know that in the early days of ISKCON, there was one lady who was upset, you know, that the ladies were dancing in the back and the men in the front, and she was having a whole argument with the devotees about it, and then she also said, well, why can't we also dance in the front? So then it became a whole thing, and initially Prabhupada said, well, it may be, if they want you to dance in the back, then what is the difficulty? But she was very discouraged, so then Prabhupada said, all right, said, but if you really feel that you want to do dance in the front, then you can dance in the front. And she did for some time, but then as she was dancing in the front, naturally all the men were looking at her. Right? That was unavoidable. So after a while, she began to feel a little uncomfortable about it, you know. She was like, well, maybe this is not it. And so she, on her own, she went back a little bit to the back where no one was seeing. So it's not always just a matter of the externals. There's a practical reasons and whatever. The story, of course, I could give so many purports to that, but I'm only giving the purport that Prabhupada was ready to accommodate and to adjust standards and to not just hold on to this is the standard and we're going to break a person over this, you know. And he told his manager that one, we have to learn in dealing with devotees that we have to bend devotees, not break them. Right? So management is a thankless task. It is very difficult because this is the time when no one wants to be bent anymore. This is the time when rather whoever has been bent in the past is now bending back and is hitting on the head of the leaders. And it is it is becoming more and more thankless to be a leader, and therefore they're harder to find these days, right? Very hard to come by temple presidents are hard to find, and GBCs, who wants to be the target of the world? You know, like, one time, Tamal Krishnamurti, I had a discussion with him, and I also had something to say. I was the temple president of Vrindavan. I had something to say about something he was doing or was not doing. And he just told me, he said, do you know that I am the biggest target of ISKCON? And he really was in those days, definitely. Right? He said, do you know I'm the biggest target in the whole movement? Do you know how it feels? And, well, I did think about it for a moment. I mean, I did think about it. Because I've been a bit of a target myself over the years, and even now sometimes it happens. You say something and people don't like it, and before you know it, you know, it's all over. And then next thing, there's an avalanche of messages lying in your backyard, you know, and you're looking, my God, you know, 125 unanswered letters, what happened? Yes, I had only two yesterday. And then, you know, like, you look at them all, and then you see in these letters, CC, CC, and it's like, zhoof, it's like all over the planet. And you're just wondering, there are letters, you know, from everywhere. I had something like that, letters from Bucharest, letters from Tokyo, letters from everywhere about me, something I had said. God, I mean, it's already heavy enough that everything is being taped. What to speak of, you know, it's like everything I say is being taped and can be used against me any time. Even if here, everyone in this room is smiling about what I say, next year someone may hear the tape and take offense to it and then start a whole campaign on cum. You're walking on a razor's edge. It's intense, isn't it? So, like this, all of us are under constant pressure. So it is not easy these days to kind of live peacefully together. But it would be nice if in our movement we could somehow or other have a less high-strung relationship and have kind of and develop a live and let live, a kind of mood, a mood where a unity in diversity kind of mood. Everyone is different, everyone has different ideas, but anyway, let us somehow or other tolerate each other and live next to each other and try and come to some compromise rather than be too fixed in our way. Because if we have such a flexible, if we develop a more flexible mood, unnecessary offenses, unnecessary escalated situation might come. The reason why I spoke about this whole cum thing, because I downloaded this morning and it was there. Someone felt, came out with something that built up, you know, against me, and it had things in there from a whole year, you know. It started 1 year ago. Things I did 1 year ago, and they never said anything. They only said something this morning. And really going like, my God, you know, you've been sitting with this for a whole year, right? Amazing. And something similar happened in Amvix. I said something about Varna Ashram, super dangerous topic. If you dare to speak about Varna Ashram, very dangerous. And then I said the word Varna Ashram, and then someone came out and said, and last time when you were here, you know, and then the whole thing came out about the class I gave last time, which I also was thinking, wow, you know, all this time you've been thinking about what I said last time. So whatever I say, don't take it verbatim, right? Don't pin me down on words, because I'm not in court, actually, you know, and I'm sitting comfortable on a soft seat trying to make a few comments about Srimad Bhagavatam, and it's more about a spirit. I could give a lecture which is completely straight, right, and just try to stick to the purport and go achara, chara, guru, and then divide these words up and go about movable and immovable. And I know I have a different style. It's kind of very conversational and free and going all over. Stick to the theme of the verse, but I try to bring the human element. I do that on purpose because I believe that that is what we need. I think that our movement needs to consider the human beings that reside within this movement, and that they need to be appreciated within their positions, within their service, and that everyone has his sincere side, and that it shouldn't be also tense and hard, and that all these intense encounters that I've seen over the years, I kind of don't want anymore. So I guess that's an underlying theme that comes out in my I guess I had a few bashes over the head, you know, a few pokes in the back and in the front and in the side and everywhere. And at one point you just say, is this really the only way that we can push on this movement? I'm just trying to do a job, you know, like that's all, you know. Yeah? It's like I almost got crucified over the construction of Prabhupada Samadhi in Mayapur, you know, I really did. I almost got killed over being the temple president of Vrindavan, and I just wonder sometimes, was it really necessary, all this? And I guess many devotees feel like that. And therefore, if we can... therefore I'm kind of approaching, taking this verse and deriving this theme out of it, the theme that these tense dealings which come forth of everyone having his plan, his desire, his idea, his vision, my way, and it has to be like that, and all these strong personalities conflicting with one another, it makes it so hard, right, in this movement to function. So if we could take it upon ourselves to at least reflect on this, I mean, I appreciate that we have our ways, and I'm not saying we have to give them up, but anyway, if somehow or other, I don't know how, we could try to avoid sparks flying when two opposing views meet, right? That would be great. And if we could just somehow or other, live together, unity in diversity, and appreciate, I work in my way, another person works in his way, and everyone makes his contribution, ki jai. And in this way, this Sankirtan movement can maybe spread over the whole world without becoming the cause of the Third World War. Right? Which sometimes you think, you know, might happen if we don't watch out. Okay, I'll stop. Any questions, any comments?
I don't know, because the devotees, they also think because one guru falls down and the single one, other gurus are...
Yeah. What was that? The devotees, they think one guru falls down and then they think all other gurus are also on slippery ground or something like that. So you didn't fill that in. All other gurus are, and then?
Yeah, useless or something.
Useless. No, she's saying that those are just thoughts, honest thoughts being spoken without meaning offense.
Is it an offense, Mara? Just think if somebody feels like that.
No, I think that this is not an offense. I think this is honesty. One must speak his heart. It is then our trust is broken. You know, useless just means like, can we really trust anyone anymore? That's what it means. And I think we should not take a word and immediately, saha, she said the word useless, now let's carve this in marble, you know, and write the date and the name, etc., you know. And so for the next generations to remember what terrible maha apparat was made here. I think we take it in the spirit that of what the meaning is of the word. And the meaning is that, can we still trust? I mean, well, it's understandable that we are feeling like that. But we should not at the same time then give these gurus such a hard time, or any sannyasi, you know, like give them a feeling like, you know, like some places when you walk in these days as a sannyasi, people give you a feeling, you are a freak of nature. You know, you are absolutely weird. Anyway, you know, like, we'll tolerate you as long as you're around, but don't say anything wrong, okay? Right? All right, so, you know, you're kind of maneuvering like that. And then at the end of the class, you know, the hand goes up and the Mataji says, you know, how do we know that you're not going to fall down? I had this happen to me. So then you go, you know, then you go like, well, you know, please pray for me or something, you know, like, again, I say, right? So, generally speaking, sannyas is just an ashram, you know. Generally speaking, guru is just a service, you know. Someone's head of the kitchen, someone's in charge of BBT, someone's like the potato peeler, and someone's the guru. It's a service, right? Of course, not everyone can do it, right? Well, not everyone can peel potatoes, and not either, you know. Everything takes some expertise and some qualification. So to be a guru requires a certain spiritual qualification, right? It doesn't really require that one has... That one is a Mahabhagavat who has Krishna praying, and that only such a person could be guru. And Prabhupada on many occasions pointed out that many times the guru is such a person, but that others could also be guru, right? Because it is not guru who delivers the disciple. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the first chapter, it is explained that it is Krishna who delivers the disciple, and that the guru is the instrument. Right? So if he is simply faithful to the sampradaya and following everything nicely, if he controls his senses and dedicates himself in the service of Krishna, then he's okay, even if sometimes he feels the attraction to the material energy. Like it is said in the Nectar of Devotion that Uddhava, when he saw a beautiful young girl that he thought, this girl is so attractive, she just looks just like Krishna. I tell you, this girl is just attracts me just as much as Krishna. It must be Krishna dressed up like a girl, and it was. Because Uddhava cannot be attracted to some ordinary mundane girl. So that's Uddhava. But even if one is a spiritual master, one may feel the attraction of the material energy. But if one ignores that attraction, and just simply not even considers it, but cuts it right there in the mind, and remains faithful on the path of devotional service, then he's within the definition of Vacha Vega, Manasa Krodha Vega, Jiva Vega, Mudra Pasta Vega, Etan Vega, etc. He controls the mind, the actions of anger, the senses, etc. And he's qualified to make disciples all over the world. So what is a guru anyway? I mean, we should not make it too difficult also. And the gurus are sincere devotees who are very much trying to pass on the teachings of Prabhupada and who can actually guide very nicely. It's true that there have been many difficulties. Of course, especially there was a period when there were many when the zonal acharya days were at the height, then the role of guru was very artificial, was very difficult. So it is maybe we are understanding that many of the gurus in ISKCON may not be necessarily Mahabhagavat gurus, right, when they fall down. And therefore, they should be protected. They should not be given too much pressure, too much difficult, too much responsibility, too many disciples, too many expectations. They should also, too much public performance. It's intense. Even I'm just a little sannyasi, right? Amongst the sannyasi, I'm a little one. Yeah? They come in different sizes, and I'm small size. Yeah? And as a little sannyasi, Already so many expectations are there. You know, many people expect that you're a pure devotee, right? I mean, I'm not a pure devotee. I'm just trying to purify myself, that's all. What to speak of when you're a guru, you know, and a big sannyasi. They look at everything. How's he lifting his pink? This is not pure, right? It's not pure. There's something, some vanity in the way he lifts his pink, you know. See how he holds the glass when he drinks. I think he's arrogant. Yes? It's very, very... So much pressure. So we shouldn't put so much pressure also on them. That would help. That would help. That would make it less taxing. Less expectations that they are the ones who are going to do it and are going to come and give us the inspiration every time again, and that every word they speak is complete nectar, and that it's like wonderful, and all that is a lot of pressure on someone. So we should give them some opportunity to have a strong sadhana, to cultivate spiritual life. So we have not always done that. We have put too much pressure on people. So that's another reason why maybe they didn't make it. Srinivas.
If a guru interferes into the matters of husband and wife, is it good?
Well, it's very dangerous to do that. Even for a guru, that could be... It's very dangerous when you interfere in between husband and wife. You could get severe troubles. But shastrically, there is some reference that if husband and wife wish to conceive a child, that they should do so with permission of the guru. Right? That is there, mentioned in the Bhagavatam in the 7th canto. So it seems to indicate that there is some involvement in the relationship between husband and wife. But at the same time, in the traditional Vedic system, the husband was initiated and the wife was not initiated. And the wife was simply following her husband. And this way she was having her connection. So the spiritual master dealt through the husband. And that is, generally speaking, the best way to deal with things. And that's the preferred approach. But, you know, we cannot make blanket rules, right? And from now on, it is the law in ISKCON that all gurus must act in such a... That doesn't work, you know. I mean, we have to leave room for spontaneous dealings in situations according to time, place, and circumstances.
Yeah. If myself doesn't accept that personality, then my wife accepts, then it is a conflict.
Big problem. So therefore, if one does so...
What is the duty of the wife now?
Yeah, no, I understand this. This is very difficult. What should the wife do? Follow the husband or follow the spiritual master? These are crazy situations, right? So we don't want such situations. And so...
That means the wife is sentimental or what?
No, let's not talk about the wife. Let's talk about the guru. I don't want to make comments about the wife. But I'll make some comments about the guru. That I think that many gurus are in ISKCON have good qualification spiritually. Right? They are serious devotees. They're following nice. Then they become spiritual masters. And that service is also a service. One has to learn. It's not that if you become a spiritual master that overnight you are expert in every aspect of dealing with people. You will also sometimes maybe make a mistake or this, that, and you have to learn. So I think that we are seeing also that in their dealings, many of our spiritual masters are maturing, because they have to learn also. They have to see, well, if I give this kind of advice, then I get these and these reactions. I won't do that next time, right? So it is natural that that the experienced spiritual master in ISKCON will be careful in getting in instructing in between husband and wife. But in the absolute sense, the order of guru is higher than the order of husband, shastrically speaking. What can I say?
If it's initiated by Prabhupada already.
I'm sorry, if somebody's initiated.
If somebody is already initiated by Prabhupada.
Yes.
And then he or she takes the second initiation from somebody else, and that guru falls down.
And if now,
by chance, if she becomes sentimental or he becomes sentimental, then she finds another guru.
Yeah.
And then there is a clash between husband and wife.
Yeah.
Well, this looks like a very complex situation where somebody will have to make an adjustment to somebody. Right? Now we have to see who feels the strongest in the whole situation.
And if the guru comes in between the household life then?
Yeah,
this is getting more troublesome. It was already so troublesome.
Then the guru should be away from that. He should not come in between. The guru should not come in between the household life.
It would be advisable. I agree with you. I wish upon the guru that he need not have to do that, you know. No, I think it's better not. But Srinivas, I think that the situation is very complex, that spiritually he has a right to do it, but that practically he'd better not, okay? Because it looks very, very difficult. But sometimes the situation has become so extreme that it is necessary that someone mediates between husband and wife. Sometimes the husband beats the wife, or the wife beats the husband, you know. I mean, I know one case where the wife was regularly beating the husband, and they needed a mediator. Huh?
That means he was not a man.
Well, it's Kali Yuga. Maybe she was not a woman either, I don't know. But the case was there. Yeah, so it's complex. Maybe I cannot say more about it because I'm speaking principles when I sit in the Vyasasana. And when we want to get into complete detail, I could maybe give even a better advice, but then we do it off the site, I think, because it gets too complex, really. This is it.
I said in principle the guru better...
It would be wise to not meddle in between where it can be avoided, but that shastrically... He has a right.
Okay,
he has a right.
Because many gurus are interfering into the household affairs.
Yes.
That's why there is so many devotees in ISKCON.
Yeah,
I think therefore that experience teaches us that it is a difficult matter and that maybe we should be... that the spiritual masters could consider that.
But I'm not the one to dictate them.
You know, it is up to them ultimately to decide. Yeah. Brahma.
It's not the ISKCON gurus who are the cause for all the divorces. That's wrong to me. Sorry.
Yeah, it happens.
It may happen, but that's
most
not the
of
cause.
The cases.
Right.
No.
Right.
Yeah,
it's true. See, I mean, it's like
the matter is even more complex than that. So I think you have opened up what we call a can of worms. And if you don't mind, we're going to temporarily put the lid on because there's too many worms crawling out of the can right now. And there's more than we can deal with all at once. So we beg you to leave it at this. I saw...
If you don't hear this thing, then in the society something...
Okay, well, we'll put it on the agenda of things to be cleared.
Meanwhile, I saw another hand in the back.
That you were mentioning that the guru doesn't need to have, for instance, Krishna prema.
Yes.
Mahabharata.
Yes, yes.
But it is also stated that one can get Krishna prema only from the devotee. Either this may be either your shiksha guru or diksha guru.
Where is that stated?
It's all over the place.
Where is it all over the place? One
guru? I don't know.
Then I'm not satisfied. No, I think that there are different possibilities to receive Krishna prema.
For example, in the Harinam Chintamani, we find a description at the end, the Smarana Dasa stage, where one comes to the point of receiving Krishna Prem, and that Krishna Prem then is bestowed upon one through one who has Krishna Prem, and that one is given the 11 symptoms of his spiritual identity and so forth, right? And that, like here, it is really a case of what is called Siddha Pranali, where the stage of perfection is being passed on by a guru. But I think that the verse Yasya Deva Parabhaktir Yata Devita Guru Dascheta Katitaya Tapakasante Mahatmanaha is also a verse on the other side of the scale. And that it also points out there is another way, the way that one follows the instruction of the spiritual master and everything can be automatically revealed. It is said that one can attain full perfection. One can attain full perfection in the process of devotional service even without initiation, merely by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, right? Although it is very, very difficult. So one can make a clear case that Krishna Prem is also available through the Bhagavad Vidhi and not necessarily to the Panchatriki Vidhi. Of course, one is always connected to a devotee. There's also the verse where it is pointed out that Dhruva Maharaj was offered to go back to Godhead, and then he didn't want to go alone, he wanted to take his mother. And then it is described how Dhruva took his mother as his Siksha Guru, but he became more advanced as his Siksha Guru, and he was taking his Guru back. And Prabhupada in the purport is also giving a whole explanation how sometimes the disciple can become more advanced than the Guru and can take the Guru back. So the point is this, the disciple can become more advanced than the Guru. So it is not absolutely a fact that it is commonly accepted that we must find someone who is Krishna Prem to give us Krishna Prem. I would think that in ISKCON it was never so much stressed like that. I think that outside of ISKCON in Vrindavan it is very much stressed like that. And I have also seen that over in the last few years, some influence from outside of ISKCON came into ISKCON, and that this point became more stressed than it ever was before. But therefore, I like to also make a case on the other side of the issue. I think both are possible. That's my understanding in the matter. But the other point is this, is that what if your guru, since she raised the issue, and it's the last thing I'll say and then stop, what if the guru doesn't have Krishna Prem, right? Can he take us back to Godhead? Right? This is the other question. That's the bottom line. So the answer is, yes, he can. He can take us back to Godhead. And the question may be extended. Do we need Krishna Prem to go back to Godhead? The answer is no. That refers back to the first class I gave when I came here about the mercy principle, right? And how by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, even if one is not perfect, one can still be taken back to Godhead. So therefore, our process is not necessarily that we all have to reach Krishna Prem now in this life, and then only we can go back to Godhead. All we have to do is to the best of our ability try to satisfy our spiritual master in Krishna, and with that we may attract the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who in turn may take us back to Godhead if he desires so. And he's very merciful, that's for sure. Okay, so our gurus are not useless. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.